of youth, we started about 13 years ago, and we were really interested in interrupting the school-to-prison pipeline in Oakland. And we were interested in systems change and in being a model for other places. And so we started in a few schools and were able to really implement whole school restorative justice to train teachers and administrators and to get the ear of the superintendent. And in so doing, we're able to make a statistically significant reduction in suspensions and expulsions and truancies and an increase in test scores. And so all of that together, we began to kind of roll that out in other schools. And together with OUSD, we were able to get the school board to adopt restorative practices as its official disciplinary policy as opposed to punitive policy. And so we're kind of known nationally for that. The district was then able to hire 30 restorative justice practitioners and have a $3 million a year budget. And so that's the success of the work. There are some challenges, though, there. We still have enduring racial disparities, even though the school district no longer uses willful defiance as a ground for suspensions, but they're just these enduring kind of racial disparities, and so we've developed restorative justice training that focuses on implicit bias and racial harm. So that's one thing that shifted for us. We've shifted out of schools and into the juvenile justice system, so we're in we kind of like to call it the juvenile legal criminal system because we don't really feel like there's a lot of justice in that system. But we currently work in juvenile home, juvenile camp, holding restorative justice circles and reentry circles when people are coming back into community. So that's kind of the area that we're most known for and the area that we continue to work in. But it's only 1/4 of all of our work. Another 1/4 is training, education, and consultation, which we do all over the world. We were most excited about doing this work in Kenya in May, and we just came back from a training of our own around indigenous healing in South Africa, where the whole staff went in December and January. And we're also involved in a big truth-telling and racial healing project, which is another 1/4 of our work. And then our community restorative justice work, which includes this vision of Oakland as a restorative city. So I guess I feel like I'm talking too much, so I've shared that, and now I'm just kind of interested in your thoughts or what's going on for you or questions that you might have or comments.
Deborah, thank you.
Yeah, so thanks for that introduction. When I hear folks talk about whole school restorative justice or restorative practices, what comes to my mind is that it's multi-tiered, right? So you're not just waiting till something happens and conflict arises and responding. You're responding in a proactive way, universally. Everyone's trained in some capacity on certain aspects, and then you have some targeted interventions, and then of course the more intensive, you know, conferencing or reintegration models that you're using. So, you know, in my work with schools and trying to push them along the journey of systems change and whole school change, what I see them struggle with is, you know, viewing this work as a framework, right? It's a grassroots. Mm-hmm. It depends on the culture and the context of each setting. Where, you know, I'm not there to tell them what to do, and in large part, I can't because I don't know what they're operating with. You know, in Indiana, there aren't there aren't there isn't funding for restorative justice coordinators in each building. And so they've got to make do with what they have. So my big struggle is pushing educators beyond just the basic, you know, check-in or community building circle in the morning. teachers feel like they don't have the time to do anything beyond that, and are still in this punitive mindset of, you know, you're not doing what we need you to do in this room, go somewhere else and figure it out and then come back. I'm just curious if you could talk about kind of targeted interventions, or what we would call, you know, tier two interventions, and or how to push teachers beyond just the basic check-in.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's something that we are familiar with in the different places that we do the work. I mean, it's one of the reasons why we advocate for whole school restorative justice. We feel like it's really problematic and challenging to implement restorative principles and practices in these very, you know, in selective settings within a school, right? And it also sends a conflicting message to youth who may feel like, oh, RJ is for building community, but whenever something really serious happens, when harm happens, the school reverts to a punitive approach. And so that sends a mixed message and actually results in a kind of divestment in belief in the power of the practices. So we also have this, we're aware of this kind of challenge that sometimes in working with schools, they see RJ as another tool, as only another tool, like PBIS and SEL, right? They're RJ, PBIS, SEL, that they're kind of the same, and we pull them out of our toolkit when we need an approach. And yet we try to always present restorative justice as a worldview, as a, you know, fundamental shift, and not just a set of tools. And then we try to remember that and kind of give examples of how it's easy to drift back into simply seeing this as a set of tools. And so that comes up a lot. I would say that so much so that one of our a major funder has recently asked us to, and we're doing this project where we're developing a media campaign that's focusing on teachers statewide, anticipating some of the backlash, I would say, to implementation of restorative practices. Mm-hmm. As you were saying, that sometimes teachers feel like they don't have the time. In Oakland, teachers say, I don't have the time not to, because it reduces my mediation of conflict and ineffective mediation of conflict if I don't do it. So the teachers here are more kind of bought in, because I would say that we've had a full cultural shift, even though, you know, it's one of those things that's in process. But if you talk to your average teacher, they know what RJ is. They generally have a positive feeling about it, even though they may have some criticism. So I feel like it's around cultural shift and around the whole school and the whole school system, the district, moving towards these practices and having a deep and true buy-in. What else can I say about that? But what you're raising is something that is definitely up front. I think it depends on the impulses of the community prior to the implementation of restorative practices. Mm-hmm. Someone was trying to deliver a piece of mail, and I'm the only one here, so they're talking to me, and I'm doing hand signals with them. But anyway, we're in this, you know, progressive community in Oakland, California, where there's been a lot of support for movements, right, and for, you know, progressive political movements. And I would say that with the implementation of restorative practices is seen that way. But we've done training in very conservative communities where there's a pushback around the perceived absence of accountability, right? So there's this way in which sometimes teachers and school districts think that a punitive, that one must be punitive in order to have accountability. So they see punitive measures and accountability as equal, as opposed to that there's the possibility of having accountability without being punitive, you know, being truly restorative and engaging you. I'll also say, you know, I went to Hull, England, the first restorative city in the modern era, first restorative city on the planet in the modern era. And I went to a restorative justice conference there, but I also toured schools and child protective services and talked to police officers who all practice with restorative justice. And they all reported that you know, the rest of their work was easier. The days went by more seamlessly than before they were implementing restorative practices. So the teachers collectively, you know, recognized and reported on this happening, even though they spent this 20 minutes at the beginning of every class day in circle. And then they identified their own people to host harm circles when there was some kind of identifiable harm, and a tier two circle was needed. Is that helpful? I don't know.
Yeah.
But it is a question sometimes of resources too, and you know, we find that we get contacted often when school districts or individual schools or even for-profit organizations or families are having conflict and they want a harm circle. And when we conduct a harm circle, which we're in the process of like 8 of them right now with different entities, some are national organizations, some are local families, you know, just a range of things. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of resources. And if you don't have a culture in a school that supports that, it's really hard to do the adequate prep. And if you don't do the adequate prep, then, you know, we have found if you rush into it, don't do adequate prep, that sometimes those things backfire. And then people emerge or leave the process with not a positive experience with the practice. So I would encourage, you know, trying to get the resources and identify the time, allocate the time when those harm circles are needed to engage in them and do them, you know, well, do them right. Other questions or thoughts, reflections people have?
Go ahead, Jan, your mic is open.
Jan, I have a question. Could you say more about when you are entering you're just starting in a system that's operating in a traditional punitive way and you're going in to do a harm circle, would you say more about what kind of preparation is needed in that circumstance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we are strong advocates of ongoing, community building circles. So we say that, like, the relationship between harm circles and community building circles is probably like 8 to 1 or 9 to 1. So I hear feedback. So really we expect that schools, you know, classrooms, school districts are doing, you know, 80 community building circles to every 10 or, you know, 20 harm circles. But in going into an environment where there is maybe resistance to these practices or a more conservative or punitive view, we just kind of assume that is the way that we're socialized, in the same way that we're socialized in a kind of racist society, we're socialized in a punitive society. And so whether people are aware that that's operating for them or not, we know that that's often, you know, at play. And so we try to focus on the strengths and that brought us there. So someone called us and asked us to come, right? Someone thought that it was important to have a harm circle or a conflict circle. And so we try to understand that little seed in that community of hope around restorative practices. Where does that come from? And who are the allies in that? So we focus on that. We also just focus on healing, right? You know, everyone wants to feel good about a decision that's made that fracture, that helps to heal a fracture in the community, whether that be because a young person, you know, I don't know, stole something or hurt someone physically, or is hurting themselves for because of the actions that they're taking, that we try to really engage all people at in their higher selves, you know, in their capacity to really want healing and help for the whole community and for themselves. And it just feels good to relate in those authentic ways. And so when people sit in circles, oftentimes it's the administrators and the teachers themselves who get to be authentic in those harm circles, who get to talk to youth and tell them, you know, how they feel, how they have possibly been, you know, directly impacted by the actions of the youth or of each other, that it's really freeing for them, and they have their own transition. And so we feel like the way to kind of collect advocates is to have people be transformed directly by these practices. And, you know, we're all human, and we all want to have kind of a peaceful reconciliation whenever there's harm that's done. And so we just kind of lean into that and have found that even the most, you know, the people that we think of maybe or that the community thinks are the most punitive in their approach, that they also lean into these practices and feel good about them once they've had the opportunity to sit in circle and to be seen and to feel like they can be their authentic self in relating, you know, to youth, for example, in a school environment. Are there other questions, or is that helpful, or is there, does that speak to what you were asking?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. Are there other questions or comments or thoughts?
Can you say anything about, do you do like grief work, or, you know, so often I have a little bit of exposure to like notions of organizational development, and so like the type of how does that, do you try to prime the community for the restorative justice work with kind of group meetings or something to kind of talk about, to have maybe the leader of the school or other stakeholders talk about, you know, where you've been, where you are, and and why you're using restorative justice in the way that you are, and you know, talking about the staff about that, or the organization, the wider organization.
Mm-hmm. You know, honestly, we don't do so much of like convincing people that this is a good practice because of, you know, their needs. We try, usually schools or, you know, representatives from schools, the district, you know, administrators, or even, you know, as I said, people in families, people in for-profits, they usually reach out to us, and because we don't advertise at all, we don't try to get business in those ways, and we get at least, you know, several calls a day to do this work. So there's a way that we just sit in circle with people. We just engage them. The administrators, kind of everyone at all levels, we try to start with the people who are decision makers or who have the most influence because they can change a system. So we start with principals and administrators and district personnel. But it's not so much about convincing them that this makes sense. We do, you know, show the research. And in fact, we were recently funded to develop a restorative justice research institute here in California. And I'm a research professor, and, you know, I'm really interested in that. But there's a way that we feel that the transformative power of these practices is in the lived, the personal experience, the direct experience of the practice. So it is kind of unusual. You know, sometimes we'll have a CEO who's, you know, very busy, or the dean of a university who's also very busy. But, you know, our work is then to get them in circle. And we do that even with our funders. We have, you know, funders, significant large foundations, and we'll get their vice presidents in circle. And so we feel like there's this something that happens, you know, in the brain and the body with this kind of intentional leaning into intentionally cultivating compassion that is transformative. And it happens at a level that's bigger than an intellectual level. You know, it's a feeling level, and that's what changes hearts and minds. And so the work is really that. It's trying to get them in circle, getting them to see how this impacts each other, how it impacts young people. And we have been most effective in those ways, rather than, you know, like in like a meeting to kind of teach that. In community, we do it by just hosting community circles. You know, we host community circles all the time. Right now, this year, we're doing 300 community circles, healing circles, in one of our contracts. So, you know, I'm in circle almost every day. And we, some of those circles, I guess you had asked this question about grief circles specifically. In Oakland, we have historically had a very high level of homicide and gun violence. And so we respond to every homicide that we're aware of by offering a grief circle. And that often has, you know, the people who are most impacted by the harm, but it could be the entire community. And we host them in community churches and community centers and our office in people's homes. And those are circles of remembering and circles of, you know, kind of resolve, what people resolve to do as a result of the violence or the harm that has occurred. But we have, you know, we do that a couple times a month or whenever it arises, that there's a need for that level of, you know, kind of a grief circle. But we do that also in schools where, and in juvenile hall, where young people have a lot of trauma and a lot of loss, and a lot of the trauma has not been processed or acknowledged. And there are ways, I remember once we were in juvenile hall and we were hosting a circle, and it was somebody's birthday. And so we sang, I think, happy birthday to that person. And there was a reflection and a question about birthdays. And it came out that of the 11 young boys who were in that circle, they all had trauma associated with their birthdays, where horrible things had happened on their birthdays. There were loss of a parent or someone kind of OD'd on the day of their birthday, or their birthday was forgotten, or they weren't, you know, kind of, they felt like they weren't adequately acknowledged or celebrated. And so our response was to, you know, the next week when we were there, to bring, you know, a birthday cake, and it was just hard to do in juvenile hall, but we were able to do that, and, you know, kind of celebrate everyone and have some deep reflection on needs, right, and on expressing the sadness that people had and what are their true needs. So a way of processing that sadness and grief around opportunities to celebrate that had been missed, and then how to, you know, hold on to the opportunities that they have for the future to celebrate themselves. So does that answer it? I know it was a roundabout way.
Yes, thank you. Yes, thank you.
I also would like to, this is Molly, I just want to welcome people who are arriving. It looks like we have someone here from Boston. If you'd like to introduce yourself, please feel warmly welcome to do so. Otherwise, at any time, just unmute yourself by pressing star 7. And Tiasha, if I may, I have a really burning question that is a bit of a thread in these small group mentoring sessions. And it has to do with staff process and just cultivating, you know, cultivating an environment within our staff, you know, within our office, even, you know, maybe being on the same page with our board or with our directors. How do you go about really helping to cultivate and build trust with your staff, with all the different pockets of, you know, organizational hierarchy that you might have to work with or work within? How does that work for you at RJOY?
My heart,
just in general.
Thank you. I don't know how it works in general. I'm happy to take this question. I don't know how it works in general. I know how it works at RJOY, and it warms my heart. I have this huge smile on my face because I feel like so good about our relationships and how we cultivate just a sense of being on the same page and also just authenticity and radical honesty among our staff. So, you know, we teach these practices as these are practices for ourselves too, right? So we're very much interested in our own emotional health and our own healing and our own real journey. So when we're in circle with youth, and as I said, we're in circle, you know, every day, virtually, sometimes several times a day, our youth particularly demand that we are radically honest, that we are truly authentic. So we get to know each other very, very deeply. I think that, so we have an amazing staff. It is, and I think a part of that is that they feel like they can be their authentic selves and they're on their own kind of healing journey, let's say, around, you know, kind of an emotional life that is full and that's real and that's honest. So we have people on our staff who have the real lived experiences of the people we serve. We have people who are formerly incarcerated, who've been incarcerated for over a decade. You know, we have people who have been homeless. We have people who are in the LGBTQ population. We have people who just have these, you know, who are artists and people who have left their other careers that were very kind of stable and mainstream to do this thing that they feel called to. So I would say for all of us, we feel that this is a calling as opposed to just a job. And so just administratively, let's say, what do I do around those things? I try to ensure that we can live in this healing, kind of radically honest way. And so that means challenging dominant stereotypes about how we're supposed to be, because circle requires us to remove some layers of defense and when we relate to other people, right? So in some ways, we're very vulnerable because we're sharing deeply of ourselves. And being in circle requires that. You know, we've talked about the concept of salbona, seeing, it's a South African Zulu concept of seeing into each other's soul, seeing each other truly and deeply. And so so we try to do that. And then I try to create opportunities for everyone to just work on themselves and to infuse that work into our practices. And so as a result, for example, the whole staff went to South Africa in December 28th. Through January 11th, we were all there studying with these traditional healers, living, you know, together in a room, walking barefoot on the land and going through ceremony and ritual, all funded by our funders who support the infusion of traditional indigenous healing practices into restorative practices. Like, we don't see those as separate. We see those as deeply integrated. And then, you know, we try to walk the talk. So part of that is feeling kind of, for me, it's about having the audacity to, you know, follow that vision and to kind of implement it and to support our staff along the way. That sounds kind of, I don't know, maybe radical, but that's kind of how we do it and what we think works.
Thank you. And do you have policies in place in your policies and procedures with, because you do have a convening board, I'm assuming?
So we're actually a fiscally sponsored project of community initiatives. So we are not our own 501c3. We have an advisory.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have an advisory committee that's made up of who used to be the presiding judge, juvenile court judge, and elected officials. But, you know, they're all people who very much support all that we're doing, who really get it, who are just incredibly encouraging, and also who don't overstep and recognize. I mean, many of us have, you know, I have 25 years of experience in fundraising. I have a development director who has 40 years of experience in fundraising. So our board very much doesn't try to lead us in that. They try to support us in that. But they recognize that we have more, you know, expertise in those areas. We are governed by the policy and procedures of community initiatives, which is our fiscal sponsor. We chose to do this. I mean, we're large enough by far to be our own 501c3. We've made the intentional decision, at least up to this date, to be fiscally sponsored because we feel like we get the economies of scale. We get great health benefits and we get great retirement, you know, contributions and things like that that as a nonprofit on our own we wouldn't be able to do. And we're not paying as much for, like, the legal representation and the HR that we can get, you know, together with other organizations. So, but we do have, like, our own, I don't know what you would call it, we have our own policies beyond them. And so one of them that we have is a self-care policy that we implemented where all staff get $500 a year to use however they want on themselves, recognizing that there's high secondary traumatic stress or vicarious traumatization from being in deep, close community with the people we serve who have a lot of trauma in their lives. And so the way that our staff use their self-care funds each year, you know, they get massages or they go on a yoga retreat or they go on the mindfulness meditation retreat or they just use the $500 for a gift card for hotels.com. You know, they do a range of things, but I think it's more about recognizing that the organization is investing in them and people spend more time thinking about how they'll use their self-care funds than actually using them. I oftentimes have to force it, like, it's the end of the fiscal year, I need you to use your self-care funds, you know, but it just feels like support to staff to have that. And then there are lots and lots of training opportunities. They travel a whole lot because we train all over the country. You know, everyone gets extra pay for travel because we travel so much, people actually don't want to do it so much. And so they're just, you know, ways. We have competitive salaries, I would say, and are also really, really reasonable about workload. And, you know, a lot of this work is done in the evenings and on weekends. And so we just have balance there and expect people to, like, take care of themselves when they're not working and when they're working. So I hope that, is that what you're asking, Molly? I'm not sure.
Oh, it's a wonderful picture, you know, with evidence of how you are creating such a rich environment that obviously is a very successfully built environment with strong intention. And you helped to create that. Thank you. And that's what I'm hearing, at least. So you've given some really mm-hmm. practical examples of how you do that. And that it really is a culture shift too within a staff, because it is very scary to be vulnerable. It's very mm-hmm. scary to unpack all of the conditioning that we have mm-hmm. together as a staff and under such pressure. So it sounds like you have some wonderful ways to really support your staff in supporting themselves. And
it's true. And we also, staff will quickly and easily say, I need a support circle. So we routinely, I held one at my house on Friday. You know, like we routinely support each other. And I mean, at all levels from, you know, the founder, you know, to, you know, a youth who just got out of juvenile hall. So there's a way that, you know, anyone can ask for a circle or it can be offered to anyone. And we really do it. It's not just like, oh, mm-hmm. It's for everyone, and everyone feels good about it. Like it feels supported and feels held when that's offered.
That's really nice to hear. So you do support circles, and you feel everybody feels an equal chance at voicing that need. Mm-hmm. Also, what happens if there is more serious conflict between staff? Is it also a support circle that can be called, or how does that work?
We've had conflict circles before between staff or between staff and like maybe interns or volunteers. So we would, you know, if it's support, it's a support circle. But if it's conflict or harm, it's a conflict circle. And we do all the things we do for a conflict circle, which, you know, include all the prep. It, you know, all the same thing. So we would do all the prep. We would take the longest prep I've ever done was for a staff and volunteer conflict circle where I prepped one person for 12 hours. Not all at once, but, you know, we waited. We really, really engaged in that. And so we noticed that a lot of RJ organizations don't walk the talk. Like, that's for those people. It's for everybody else except for us. And we practice this on ourselves. You know, we really do. We practice conflict circles, support circles. We just are people who deeply believe in these practices. And, mm-hmm. You know, so we do walk that. And I think the other thing is like there isn't a bunch of like shame or guilt or any associated with those things, you know. It is, you haven't asked this question, but maybe you alluded to it, like, what about hierarchy? And what about, I mean, I feel like I try for us to not have hierarchy, but at the same time, it is true that, you know, some people are high, they have supervisors, you know, I supervise their supervisors kind of thing. It is true that we could have to, we have to evaluate everyone and their performance evaluations. And, you know, we have been really gracious and graceful in entering into relationships with staff and exiting them. And we do that also in a non-punitive way, you know. And sometimes we have a lot of folks who want to work for us, and we are very careful about bringing people on, you know, because of the closeness and the depth of connection. We interview people 5 times. You know, it's a lot for us to, because we know about the level of investment that we have with each person as we bring them on.
Thank you. I don't want to take up too much of the airwaves. It just seems like such a burning question that's not just coming from me, but from a lot of people, and wondering what are the basics around setting, setting an environment that is based in, you know, matching the values with the practices. So thank you, Tayasha.
Mm-hmm.
Really appreciate that.
My pleasure.
And just welcoming people who are entering the room. Again, if you'd like to introduce yourself, please do, or just join in the conversation. I know Dr. Bankhead is asking for challenges and for what you might be curious to know about their work, which, you know, honestly, I consider restorative justice for Oakland youth to be the one of the top leaders. I know we're not in a hierarchy here, but really the program that you've developed, as you're describing, Tayasha, is really one that's looked up to by many, not just in the United States, but much beyond, for how to build programs in, you know, in different pockets of our community.
Thank you. Well, we always say that there are no experts in restorative justice. We're all in it, you know, we're all, and we believe that. So, but, you know, we're working on these things, and it feels like a very, I'm in the office right now, and no one was here when I got here at 10, but people will be here, you know, tonight when I leave. But there's a way that they're all here now. They've walked in as I've been on the call. And, you know, it feels like a home. You know, we have a living room, kind of, we have like a kitchen. And we think of welcoming people in that radical, we think about the core value of radical hospitality as guiding our work with each other and with the people we serve.
So I know, Tayasha, we were opening up for questions and comments. Is that still where you're at? Would you like to? I know we've had a couple more people join us since earlier, and so now we have about 10 people all together in this small group mentoring session. Just wanting to update mm-hmm. everyone on that. Yeah.
Thank you. And how long are we going today? I'm thinking of the time.
It's up to 2 hours, but it's as long as people have a need and have specific
okay.
things that they want to bring.
Okay. All right. So, yes, I'm open to other questions that people might have or comments.
Well, this is Kalima, and, you know, as a newbie, I am wondering, you know, about how to, I really appreciate, I'm just very moved by all that your program offers, and I'm wondering, do you offer, is there like an introductory packet? Is there something that I could bring into my community, have someone come and offer a introductory workshop to this concept for communities that mm-hmm. are, you know, still operating in the old system?
Mm-hmm. We typically do, we do trainings all over the country and the world. And the intro to restorative justice circle keeping or RJ 101 is a 2-day training that we offer, and it's with two facilitators, and we would be happy to do that. So we do it in just basically almost every state we've traveled to and throughout California where we are. And then like in May, we're going to Kenya. And we'll be training in Nairobi, meeting with the Minister of Education, training some people at a nonprofit, and then doing training 60 teachers at 10 schools on the practices and then training 60 youth in the community, all with the goal of reducing the school burnings that happen pre-election when they have national elections. So, but yeah, we do trainings here in the U.S. and some school districts will train the whole district. We will start with the 101, Restorative Justice 101, Struggle Keeping Intro 101. And then we usually will do consultations. So once a month, 2 hours, we'll meet virtually and check in about how people are doing with implementation. And then we might come back in a few months or the next year and do a more advanced training. So for conflict circles. We don't do conflict circle training unless we know that there are people who are actually practicing community building circles and have had exposure to RJ 101 training. And we like there to be some time in between because we feel like things come up in the practice and we really need that experience before doing harm circles, which are much more involved. And I mean, even us, even our founder, who's been a lawyer and who's been doing this for, 15 years or so, she never really does a harm circle alone. We always do that. We train in pairs and we conduct virtually all of our circles with co-facilitators.
And is it mostly geared through schools?
Not only. I mean, we started out that way, and I would say, so we co-chaired the last national conference, the NACRJ, the conference that Molly was talking about that's this year in Denver, Colorado in June. The last one was in 2017 in Oakland, and we RJ co-chaired that and coordinated a group of 30 RJ organizations to come together to kind of help to plan that. And in that conference and at the upcoming conference, I would say about half of the people are educators or more. So it's very much something that schools are interested in. So there's lots of training for schools. But we also do these trainings in community. We do them in nonprofits. We've even had for-profits who are interested in the training. So, and we have a vision of Oakland as a restorative city. So the Oakland as a restorative city work involves infusing the practices throughout the city and city government and child welfare and mental health. We've trained the police. So really this deep infusion requires exposure and training in different environments other than the criminal legal system and school. But I would still say more than half of our trainings are in schools, universities in K-12, and with, school administrators. And then the next group would be those who serve youth, like after-school programs and, those kinds of environments.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Other questions or comments? I want to say this thing. I'm so excited about everybody coming together and, I'm happy that you're here on the call and interested in these practices. I feel like, and this is something we think about and talk about a lot here at Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth, we are concerned about restorative justice fidelity in an environment right now where there's a lot of support in theory for restorative practices. So, at least where we live in Northern California, there are many grant proposals that government is issuing that are asking for restorative justice, related practices that they're funding. A lot of private foundations are interested in funding this. It feels like when I'm at conferences that are not RJ conferences, people are still talking about restorative practices. And they're talking about them in ways that sometimes challenge fidelity. And they're practicing them in ways that really sometimes counter the original vision of restorative work, or just the mission of this work. And so I just encourage everyone to be mindful of that, that, you know, we're constantly thinking about, is this punitive or is this restorative in every conversation we have, and, you know, the decisions that we make, and just how we walk in the world. And so I just think it's a vulnerable time for the practices, because right now there's such an interest in them that virtually anything that I always say, you can slap restorative justice on the front or end of anything, and people get more interested in it, whether or not it's actually being true to restorative principles or not. Do you guys see that? I mean, is anyone aware of what I'm talking about, or am I the only one who's thinking of this?
Would you unpack that a little more for us? Maybe that I'm not so immersed in restorative justice. I hear, you know, the punitive versus restorative language, but mm-hmm. I'm not really getting what you're speaking of.
Mm-hmm. The way that it typically shows up is like in a school setting, where the school will want to use restorative community building circles when there isn't conflict, like let's have a, you know, circle check-in at the beginning of the day. But they may not, it might be practiced in a way that's hierarchical, right, where the youth don't really get to be authentic, or it gets policed, like how people show up maybe in the circle or how authentic they can be. So that's one way that that's not being practiced with fidelity. And then in that same school that may say that it's practicing restorative justice, whenever there's conflict, they may not respond. You know, they may change their response from a restorative response to a punitive one. So they may have, for example, zero tolerance rules that don't take a step back and sit in circle with youth and try to explore really what happened, you know, who's impacted. They've shift from trying to be restorative in one breath and then being punitive in another. So that's a way of not practicing with fidelity that's authentic to the vision or the intent of the practices.
And Tayasha, I'd like to just share Molly here. How important this conversation is, and as we, you know, see such a rise in restorative justice implementation in, you know, our world, oftentimes, like as you described earlier, there's a reversion to the punitive if there aren't, you know, basic agreements, and even in some cases, it seems like policies in place. Although I love the way you describe how you've built your team, and you know, the founder built the team up in a way that almost seems to remove the need to have actual policies in place. I've observed it in organizations in the country. You know, when there's internal staff conflicts or you know, things come up, a lot of times people are even let go because mm-hmm. of the conflicts that could have been handled in a restorative way are handled punitively.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so much of it has to do, I think, with even family of origin, you know, kind of messages that people feel about, like that they have to respond in a punitive way. It's hard to imagine something else. And I mean, I believe that it's good to have some policies. Zero tolerance policies, I kind of across the board don't think are a good idea. But I think that it's good to have some expectations, some structure, absolutely. And then it's also good to be able to, within that, build in a space for human experience, for people to voice what's, you know, their what has happened to them, and for there to be clarity. Oftentimes young people, when harm has occurred, when they're either the person who's caused harm or the person who's received it, they don't express what really happened because they're afraid of the consequences, or they feel so shut down by those policies. They feel like no one will even listen to them. There's no room for their actual individual humanity in it. And so oftentimes if we hear the story, most reasonable adults would say, oh, wait a minute, you know, we need to have a different response. If we hear the full story, and sometimes that full story is about the home life, it's about, you know, kind of trauma exposure, you know, it's other more complex things. Are there any other questions or comments?
No? I'd just like to remind everyone, earlier I shared the website address for Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth. It's rjoyoakland.org, correct, Tayasha?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And Tayasha, if you would just recap, if you'd be willing, you had described 20, you know, kind of like in quarters and sections, the work that you're doing. Can you just give us a recap of that? Because I know a lot of people are very interested in the fact that, you know, not only do you do work in and with schools, but you're also within the juvenile system, so to speak, and doing trainings and such. So would you be willing to recap that for us?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So
thank
I
you.
Think of our work as being organized in four different areas. And so a fourth of the work and the work that we're most known for is the interrupting the school to prison pipeline. And we started off doing work in schools and are now really doing more consultation with schools and training in schools. But most of our work where we have staff going every week is juvenile hall and juvenile camp. And so we hold two circles a week in the max unit in our local juvenile hall. We hold one circle a week in our girls unit in the juvenile hall. And then we hold a circle, one circle a week at Camp Sweeney, which is a juvenile camp. And so that's our interrupting the school to prison pipeline work. We're also, a part of that work includes this campaign to end youth criminalization as we know it, that we're working with a bunch of other nonprofits and with the Board of Supervisors and some faith-based groups. And so that's one area. The second area is this truth-telling and racial healing mapping project that really looks at racial healing and implicit bias and really recognizes just the rise, or at least the rise in our acknowledgement of the senseless killing of unarmed Black men by police, and a desire that we have had to kind of uplift the healing work around racial conflict that's happening nationwide. And so we're going around the country interviewing people who are doing that work and creating basically a coffee table book. It's a narrative research project on that. And then the third area is our education, training, and consultation work, which could be all of our work because the demand is so great for that. But it's the work that I've talked about a lot here, where we train here in Oakland, and we travel across the country and across and all over the world, doing these different types of restorative justice circle keeping training. I was recently training at Harvard, actually, in the Harvard Divinity School earlier this year. Actually, we did, Fania Davis and I did a 3-day training in the Divinity School on restorative justice, race, spirituality, and indigenous practice. And so we very much kind of infuse what we had learned in South Africa into this restorative justice training, as well as the truth-telling work. So we went to Harvard to its slave memorials across campus and poured libations and, you know, did ritual and talked about this infusion of restorative practice and the work in that way. So training, education, consultation, interrupting school to prison pipeline, and truth telling and racial healing. And then our fourth area is probably our largest area actually right now, which is community restorative justice. And this is bringing these practices broadly out into community. So that's the area where we host the 300 circles a year just from one of our contracts. And our restorative cities work is under that. We also have a sexual harm, restorative justice and sexual harm work that is under that section of the work. And in fact, this weekend, we're hosting 45 restorative justice practitioners and a sexual harm convening in Silicon Valley in the Santa Cruz Mountains, basically at 1440 Multiversity, where we were so blessed to have funding to cover the expenses of everybody. And so everyone who's coming, at least their hotel and food, are covered, and we'll be in this really beautiful environment and infusing indigenous practice into restorative justice work and sexual harm. Many of us have been called in this Me Too time the time of the Me Too movement to do restorative justice harm circles when there's been sexual harm. And so we're all doing it, but we're kind of doing it in somewhat isolated ways. And so this convening was, the vision of this convening is to bring people together to discuss the ways in which we're practicing restorative justice with sexual harm. So we have 45 people confirmed, and it's something that we're looking forward to hosting starting on Sunday through Tuesday of next week.
So well, that's really profound work.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's wonderful news about that convening that you're going to be hosting. That's one of the cutting edge emerging spaces. So thank you for that, Tayasha. Looks like Jan has her hand up. Jan, I'm opening up your mic. And I believe, Brenda, you might have had your mic open too. So come back in if you'd still like to.
I think I'd like. I feel a little. Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I feel a little self-conscious about my participation. I wonder if Brenda still has a live question, maybe I would like to yield to her.
Am I unmuted?
Yes.
Yes.
You're unmuted now.
Thank you. I was listening here and feeling pretty mournful. Around places where I see RJ being used and talked about not with the principles and values underneath. And I'm wondering, when you see it used in the ways that you were describing, what is the impact that people experience, and how do you deal with that impact of watching it?
You mean when it's done without fidelity?
Yes, without fidelity.
Yeah. It's hard. You know, we were, one of our biggest funders gave us this nice grant, and then asked us to hold circle with them because they were so excited about our practices. So we did, or these practices, they're not ours. But we held a circle. They got really excited, and they wanted more and more. And we said, we can do that, you know, but we have to charge. You know, we talked about all that. And they said, oh, we can give you the grant, but we can't pay for our own staff to have this training. And so we went to this meeting that they were hosting where they were then using some elements of the practices, but not quite with fidelity. And I felt like I went to a party and someone was wearing my dress. That's how I felt, you know. That was the feeling of like, wow, they're doing this. It would be okay if they were wearing the dress, you know, I don't know, but with correct. But there was a way that it was challenging some fidelity, in part because they hadn't been trained, but they just had a good feeling about it. They wanted to kind of copy the practices, I think. And so what did we do? It felt, we were all kind of stunned, I would say, because there are several staff there. We kind of looked around and felt a little bit dishonored, like it was dishonoring the practices. But, you know, we quickly just leaned into it. And, of course, in the moment, I didn't really, I mean, I did talk about fidelity even in the moment when I had the talking piece. Talked about the importance of that. And then after, I talked to the facilitators about more about that. And they said, oh, we really, really want training, you know. We just, so, I mean, I feel like just keeping that conversation going around fidelity is really important. And what that means, and, you know, to encourage people to read and to study. I mean, there's, you know, the Little Book series is very much available. There are, you know, Little Book of Restorative Justice, Little Book of Circle Process. So I think there are many opportunities to, if someone's interested, to immerse themselves in at least an intellectual understanding of the practices. And then I think in addition to that, though, the way you really learn about restorative justice is by doing it, by sitting in circle, by doing community building circles and conflict circles. And so I feel like I've absolutely seen it implemented in ways that are disturbing. And I don't think that they've been like fatal flaws. I just feel like it's an opportunity to engage people in discussions about fidelity or what is their, you know, desire, what is the goal, what's their mission. Is this an RJ circle? Every time somebody sits in a circle and has a conversation, it doesn't have to be restorative justice, right? But if you're going to claim that it is, or if you're going to have elements that suggest that, then it's important to have an intention that, and to have some, you know, to be true to the practices around the elements of the circle and things like that that hold fidelity. I hope that's helpful. I don't know. I mean, that's how we have responded to these things. We've also responded by doing that, like we're developing a community of practice. We were invited by a foundation to host mentors similar to this, like mentoring sessions statewide with teachers, because teachers, people want to engage in these practices with fidelity. They just don't know how, or they don't even know that this is an issue. You know, some people may not have even thought about this. And so there's one foundation in the state that is really invested in that. There's also a work group that we're consulting with that's interested in kind of on a statewide and potentially federal level, getting restorative practices, restorative justice written into MTSS. So they're exploring what's the appropriate positionality for restorative justice and multi-tiered service system, which is a part of the kind of structures of how schools think about how they implement different types of learning. So let me, to your point earlier, Molly, I believe that it's important, you know, to have policy. Like there's a way that you can't force people, nor should we ever insist that people, you know, engage in restorative justice. But it is, I think, useful to think about the role, like, how, you know, where does RJ fit, like within schools and within school systems? Because then it creates more funding streams for people to get trained. It creates more of a conversation around fidelity and the practice.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for the question. Are there other questions?
I wanted to appreciate Jan sharing about feeling a little self-conscious and just acknowledge that this is a new endeavor of sorts of bringing people together in small group sessions, and just really thank you for your, you know, being brave to share what you're working on, what your questions might be, and just to thank you also again for, you know, being a part of this series, which we built these smaller group mentoring sessions on the basis of hearing a lot of needs across the country and in our world of, you know, just getting together and sharing what's working, what's not, and providing a platform for people to do that without having to buy a plane ticket and a conference ticket, although those are nice too. It's nice to have ongoing mentoring. So I just wanted to again, thank you for journeying with us on these sessions. So far they've been really rich. And really, thank you so much, Tayasha, for being willing to step in too. And I think it's great that you're also doing work with, you know, with teachers in the state. And I'm wondering if people are on today or going to be tuning into a recording, if the group's okay with us putting a recording of this session out, can people sign up to get on board with you for that? If they're, I guess it would be within the state of California.
Yes, they can send me an email directly, and I'll make sure that they're on our list, and they'll be invited to these. They're called the Community of Practice, but they're similar mentoring sessions and opportunities for people to engage in kind of peer support. So we'll be asking. It'll be a video conference, and like Zoom video conference type style with a maximum of about 25 people in each meeting twice a month, and folks will ask questions and share their experiences, and so we're happy to invite you. We can also invite people. We're a part of that contract involves also an annual convening here, so if people want to come to California and be in a convening to hear what's happening here, we're happy to invite you to that too. So I want to thank everyone, too, for joining us this morning or afternoon, wherever you are. It's morning here in California. And just for your thoughtfulness, it really enriches my practice to hear about your experiences and to think about, you know, just where people are and what are the cultural contexts within which you're practicing. So I feel like you've shared that today, and I'm very grateful, and of course would also like to make myself available to you if you have any individual questions or if you want, you know, training or just want some more consultation or thoughts about how you're moving forward. Feel free to contact me via email. And my email address is tiasha@rjoyoakland.org, which is T-E-I-A-H-S-H-A is my first name, at rjoy. rjoyoakland.org.
And Tayasha, I just want to thank you again. And certainly if anyone else has something they'd like to bring before we close today, just want to remind that the next session with Tayasha and Tyrese Sherrill, who is a youth practitioner, facilitator, who also had gone through the Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth Program, he's scheduled to be with us as well on these sessions, and he sends his apologies. He had a time confusion about today's session, but he will be with us next month on Monday, March 11th. That's the next session with Tayasha and with Tyrese Sherrill, who is an extraordinary young man who has some great insight to share with us as well.
Mm-hmm.
So
he does.
Yeah. Very much appreciated. And I just want to reflect back what I witnessed at the Oakland 2017 NACRJ conference was a result of a very fluid staff that you have, Tayasha. People worked really well together and seamlessly to create quite an event that had, I believe, 1,300 attendees in Oakland. It was a powerful conference. So I think everything that you're talking about around staff and creating restorative climates was well, you know, on display and enacted out in just how beautifully that conference was put together and the power of the conversations that were held there. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. It was a pleasure to pull it together, and we loved that conference. And
it was a lot of work, like, I'm sure.
Yes, it was. But it helped us. You know, we do a lot of convenings and smaller meetings, and it was the largest one we've ever done. But it was really fulfilling for all of us. We love to bring our community together, and it was just wonderful to be a part of that.
Is there any particular way you'd like to go ahead, please?
I was just going to thank you. Thank you for your wisdom and for your vision of pulling these together. I'm excited about them. I'm excited about the opportunity to connect. And I feel like we were at a conference. You know how, like, you go to these conferences and then, you know, after a session, you sit and huddle and have a little conversation about things. And that's what this has felt like for me, a little huddle. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to do that. So thank you.
Absolutely. And I'm really grateful for, again, everybody's courage to embark on something like this. It seems like it's past due in a way to leverage, you know, technical platform for the good, you know. So thank you. And is there any particular way that you would like to check out, per se, today, Tayasha?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think maybe a one-sentence checkout. We oftentimes do a one word, but I feel like a one-sentence checkout from everyone here about how you are feeling about moving forward with RJ in your life and how you plan to do it. And I can begin. So I'm feeling so optimistic and so hopeful about restorative practices. Restorative justice in my life, and there's just so much happening, like blossoming with the practices. And I think the thing that I'm most hopeful about and most looking forward to right now is the integration of kind of race and restorative justice, or implicit bias and restorative justice, which is a new training that we're offering in the spring. And I'm also interested in how this restorative cities project that we have, how that's going to roll out, like how to really infuse the practices in multiple systems throughout the city. So I'm hopeful, and I'm really inspired by all of you.
And as we checked in, would we like to check out alphabetically or just popcorn style?
Yeah, I think it's nice that however people want, but alphabetically can sometimes help people know who's next.
Yeah. Well, Brenda, you would be next if we're doing alphabetically, and then Dave and Deborah. That's about right. If you're willing.
Am I live?
Yes.
I'm not live. I am live.
You are. Yes.
I'm really appreciating this whole conversation today. I'm feeling a bit overwhelmed by the enormity of changing the worldview. And grateful. I mean, I'm inspired by what you do. I feel hopeful knowing what you're doing, hoping that that can happen here in my state.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. I'm also feeling quite overwhelmed, actually, and quite optimistic to be kind of developing a heightened level of awareness of how elaborate and progressive, I guess, some of the restorative community is. I spent last night talking about plans to potentially travel to Kenya, and I've been looking at business plans and all sorts of stuff. So just broadening my experience, and it's leaving me feeling kind of dumbfounded, but appreciative. So that's me in a nutshell right now. Thank you very much, everybody. Molly, especially.
Thank you.
The increased opportunities to come together as practitioners and those who are anywhere on this journey need each other. I often, or I feel as though I'm in isolation doing this work where I am in Indiana, and so I'm excited about opportunities like this to come together to hear about resources that are out there, and certainly the experience of folks who have been doing this a lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Deborah. I'm sorry that I cut off your mic for a minute there, but that was you, Deborah.
Yeah,
thank you. Forgive me, but the person from Boston is showing up as anonymous, so your mic is now open.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm so excited by the traction that RJoy has in this problem. It's really wonderful and so, so excited. And, you know, the work that I'm doing, I feel like we have a little bit less traction, but, you know, it feels like we have people to look up to. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your comment. We feel like we do everything in collaboration, so we don't want to be the folks that people kind of look up to, but the people that you look over to, and that we can, you know, come together and walk together on this journey. But thank you. I can also close. Was that it, Molly, in terms of the people in Circle?
There's a few more, if you're willing.
Yeah.
I can open your mic. Kalama, I'm just wondering if you'd like to check out, but certainly if you'd rather not, that's fine too, of course.
Yeah, I'm happy.
There you go. It's open.
I'm really inspired by the breadth of offering, you know, that RJ informing. And in our world, it's really totally exciting. And I'm curious about, you know, how I, as an individual in a community not connected to directly into schools or the community justice system, curious about how I can, you know, open this up in my own community.
You know, one thing is just holding, this is, I know we're checking out, but I just couldn't resist, you know, holding Circle. My children at home are like, Mom, everything doesn't, a circle's not the answer to everything, you know, because we do a lot of holding a circle space, doing that, you know, and everywhere. I teach, I do it in the classroom, I do it at home in our household because we have a renter. So just kind of walking in that way, and then I'm thinking about NACRJ, the National Association of Community and Restorative Justice, which hosts these conferences, and I'm one of the board members of that organization. I would also recommend maybe volunteering at an RJ organization in your community that you can find. So just kind of immersing yourself in the practices, even if you're not, don't have like an institutional connection through work, you can have that through volunteering.
And anyone else that would like to check out, star 2, or just simply unmute yourself by pressing star 7. Thank you. And also, Tayasha, we should give everyone a chance to say whether they'd like this recording to go out to people who were unable to attend today. But before we do that, just want to welcome Jan back in. Your mic's open now, Jan. Thank you.
Hello. I guess in checking out, I want to share that I guess I hold hope around just holding myself and others with compassion, doing my personal work, maybe engaging in more restorative conversations myself, and seeing that I could also volunteer with an RJ organization and just seeing what flows from all that.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, if any of you guys come to the NACRJ conference, I hope to meet you in person, you know, there. I'll be there, of course. And it's a wonderful opportunity to connect with people, like-minded people. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jan.
It certainly is. It certainly is.
Mm-hmm.
And just out of curiosity, Tayasha, are you going to be attending and presenting this time, or are you going to be sharing a circle there? Is there anything that we can be looking out for that you might be able to share with us right now?
Mm-hmm. I am attending and I am presenting. I'm holding a circle. And I think the one I'm doing is on race and power. It's on, you know, RJ practices and race and power. But the RJ staff, the RJOY staff, our staff members are, I think we have 4 or 5 presentations that we'll be doing there. So I may be on some other ones as well. I can't remember the details of which ones, but I know we have one on like the use of music and song in RJ circles. We, you know, ritual and ceremony is a big part of these circles. And so we have a few people who are recording artists on our staff, and they use, you know, live song a lot. And so they're presenting. One person was a restorative justice teacher before joining our staff, and she's also a recording artist, so I know she's the lead on that, Naima Shaloub. And then we have a person who was formerly incarcerated who's going to be leading a discussion of a panel of formerly incarcerated people who used restorative practices while in custody and outside in community. So they're going to be talking about the transition from being in custody to being in community and using RJ practices along the way, embodying those practices. I'm trying to think. I don't remember all 4 of the ones that we're presenting, but those are 3 that I think there's another one around creative arts, or not just song, but, you know, games and creative practices that we infuse into circles.
Wonderful.
Please come to them. Yeah, I'd be happy to see you there and have you there. And this conference is, well, the one that we co-chaired last, well, 2017, was the largest in the history of the country and we're told of the world. So it was the largest restorative justice conference ever. And this one is likely to be the top that in terms of the size. It will be larger. We've already had a lot of, you know, people register, and my guess is closer to maybe 1,700 or to 2,000 we would expect people at this conference.
And very well represented, well represented, culturally diverse, which I really appreciated. In Oakland, and I'm looking forward to it being even more so in Denver. So for those of you that are interested in more info on that, of course, it's just another powerful way to connect and be on the ground together for three days or even for the pre-training, and that's at nacrj.org. You can find out more there. And Tayasha, thank you for your service with the National Association. among all the other wonderful things that you're doing and serving in our world. So really appreciate that. I guess I'd like to check out just to say thank you again. And I, too, hold a lot of hope with the practices that, you know, as people learn more and get hands-on with them and feel that space of what it can create for accountability, for building community together especially, there's just so much to it that until you're in it and feel it and practice it, sometimes it can be hard to describe and to really know the power that's in these spaces. And I also really appreciate hearing the words compassion as we move together to build these systems and rebuild these systems together, bringing in compassion, bringing in safety to understand our own implicit biases and cultural biases and hold space for those to be honestly shared without shame, without blame, and to do that together. So thank you again, and I'll just hand it back over to you for closing thoughts, Tayasha, and then we'll see you on March 11th again.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you or talking to you on March 11th and anyone else who'd like to join us, as well as at the conference. I just, you know, as I said, the staff and I, we were in South Africa studying with these traditional healers who were actively engaged in the truth-telling and reconciliation work that was done after the end of apartheid in South Africa. And so the people we trained with were people who recognized that, you know, most of the population deeply engaged in these kind of African spiritual practices. And so they brought those in to government, actually, for opening ceremonies and for development of monuments and memorials. And so anyway, we visited a bunch of those and we engaged in ritual and ceremony, and we're bringing that back into our work. And one of the things we brought back was, one of the things we did was we traveled to Robben Island and toured, you know, where Nelson Mandela was held. And we also bought a book of his. And so I've been reading a lot of his words. And so I have a quote from that book on communication that I want to close with. And it's just a simple one-line quote. And it is, "One of our strongest weapons is dialogue." So thank you for your dialogue this morning or this afternoon. And thank you for continuing your dialogue and your practices wherever you are.
Thank you. And just a reminder, if anyone has any needs around the recording going out to a wider group, please let those be known before you leave today or via email. To the information email and tech support email that we provide in all of the communications we have with you. Thank you again, everyone. And thank you so much, Tayasha. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, Molly. Take care, everyone. Bye now.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.